Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been, and it always will be.
Okay, welcome to White Line Fever, and start the show. This is the last part of our interview with Ricky Warwick from Black Star Riders. And I think you, Ricky, you'd be very pleased with the publicity such as it is now. It's on the internet now, not in print, and
sure.
And airplay is hard to come by. But you'd be very happy with the interest in it's only your second record. There are so many now supergroups out there. I mean, you know, record companies are throwing people together and putting out these bands that maybe don't even play a show. I mean, last year we saw California Breed. They put out one record and broke up. What's the secret to keeping your head above the pack?
But this is the real deal. You know, we don't see ourselves at all as a super group. We see ourselves as a group. We've got a great gang mentality. You know, we may be getting older, but there's a great chemistry between us. We get on very well. We share a common goal. And that's very obvious to see when the band plays live. And I think everybody can see that. You know, we really enjoy what we do. And we want to make it work. And, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, we're all about the art. We're all about, you know, obviously we need to feed our families and what have you. But we're certainly, you know, our priority is writing great songs and playing great shows. And it's very refreshing to be in this band because there is a chemistry and a camaraderie and a gang mentality there that I haven't felt like I've been a part of since I was a kid. And I think that's what makes us strong. I think myself, Scott and Damon, you know, have a very clear vision for where we want to take this band and what we want to do. And then it's the real deal, you know. It's not some side project. It's not something that, you know, it gets half-arsed attention laid on it. It's a living, breathing thing that, you know, we spend, you know, 24/7 working on and talking to each other and trying to build.
And Robbie Crane's the newest addition to the band. I mean, he's been a hired gun in a number of bands. What does he bring to the band, and is he, you know, does he contribute a lot to the songwriting? You know, how does that work going forward?
Robbie's just a phenomenal bass player and a great guy. You know, he's been in a couple of bands, but obviously he was in Rat for 12 years, so you know he's got a good sense of loyalty, and he came in, you know, obviously he knew the Thin Lizzy history that was there, but he heard the first album, and that's what made him want to join Black Star Riders when we asked him to come and sort of, you know, play. And he came down and auditioned, and within 30 seconds, we knew he was the guy. It just felt right. The groove was there. He's a much more aggressive bass player than Marco Mendoza, and I think that fits Black Star Riders better. No disrespect to Marco, but I just think it's a better fit. You know, Robbie's got the precision bass down at the knees, and you know, he's just rocking hard. And he brings a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of fire, a lot of spirit, a lot of aggression. You know, fortunately, when he joined, most of the songwriting had been done for the Killer Instinct, but I'm pretty sure that Robbie, you know, now knowing him as well as I do, will be coming up with ideas for the next record.
Yeah, and last time we spoke, you said that, you know, it wasn't beyond the realms of possibility that Thin Lizzy would play one-off gigs as Thin Lizzy with this lineup. I mean, how is that?
Well, you know, it wouldn't be with this lineup if that was to happen. Right. You know, I mean, I think Thin Lizzy would only do it if it was Brian Downey, Scott Gorham, and Darren Wharton,
okay,
myself and Damon, and probably Marco back in the fall, the way it was when we were going out, you know, a few years ago. I don't know what the likelihood of that is happening. I mean, if it was to be anything, it would be one-offs. There's certainly no plans for any tours. I mean, like I said, we're all very focused on Black Star Riders, and nothing has really been mentioned. You know, That's where we're at with that, to be honest with you.
And you put out some solo stuff between records. How was that experience?
It's good. It's an ongoing thing for me. It's just something that I do and something, obviously, that I was doing before, you know, I joined Thin Lizzy. But now, obviously, that's the thing that takes a backseat to all the Black Star Rider stuff. And, I love to write, and I love to keep the solo stuff going. I enjoy doing it. It's a lot of fun for me and something I continue to do.
How have you found, and we haven't got a lot of time left, but how have you found the battle for airplay? I mean, were you disappointed with how it went the first record? Were you pleasantly surprised? Were we surprised about the regions where you got airplay and the regions where you didn't?
No, it was good. I mean, the first record charted in quite a few countries, but I mean, to be honest with you, with the Killer Instinct, we've been A-listed at BBC Radio 2 over in the UK, which is the biggest radio station. So we've been A-listed there for the last 5 weeks, which is just phenomenal. Something I could never get with any other band I was ever in, you know.
Really?
And that's to have that reach and to be getting played, you know, two or three times a day on regular rotation is huge. And we've seen the positive effect of that. I mean, the pre-sales of the record over in the UK seem to be fairly outstanding, and we're hoping that, you know, spreads across into Europe and beyond.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, we're still, you know, still firm believers. We need to get out there and we need to play it, and we need to, you know, the strength of this band is people coming to see us play live.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And obviously, I've got to ask a parochial Australian question. Any touring plans for down here?
You know, man, I love coming to Australia. I really hope that we get back soon. We would love to. I mean, obviously, it's logistics and making it work, but certainly, we'd be there in a heartbeat.
Right. How you toured with Kiss and Motley Crue a few years ago. What was that like as an experience? It was the end of the Thin Lizzy era. What are your memories of that tour?
You know, what a great way to sort of bow out, you know, on a bill like that. I mean, it was funny for me because I'd first been to Australia in 1992 with the Almighty, and we toured with the Screaming Jets.
I saw one of those shows at Shell Harbour.
That was the best time ever for me. That was just a phenomenal tour. Great guys, the camaraderie, the laugh, the mischief. The mayhem. We were all young, and you can imagine, you know, going out to places like Wagga Wagga and Broken Hill and tearing it up there was just mind-blowing, you know. So to come back sort of, you know, 20-odd years later, a little bit older and supposedly a little bit wiser, it was really nice. I mean, I've noticed a lot of big changes in the country, obviously, but again, had a great time, and just to play on a bill with Kiss and Motley Crue. You know, it was a nice way to bow out of the Thin Lizzy thing, it really was.
Give us, before we pick the last song and finish the interview, I'm going to tell us what one of the biggest changes over 20 years you noticed in Australia. What was it?
I couldn't actually believe how expensive everything
was. Yes.
You know, that was the thing. I mean, and just obviously, you know, going to somewhere like, you know, likes of Sydney and Melbourne and just seeing how industrialized and all the new skyscrapers and everything had gone up and just progress, you know?
Yeah.
That was mind-blowing. But, I mean, the people hadn't changed. The warmth and the humor and the hospitality was as good as it ever was and what I remembered it to be, you know?
There's nowhere else in the world you pay $5 for a bottle of Gatorade, Ricky. Okay, give us a...
Telling you, right?
give us a final song, and I want to thank you for your time.
Do you want to close with a Thin Lizzy song?
Yes, I'd love to.
Okay, let's just go for Jailbreak. I mean, isn't, you know, what else is there? It's such a great song.
Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. See, me and the boys, we don't like it, so we're getting up and going down. Hot and low, looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best to move away. Do you hear what I say from under my breath? Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak. Tonight there's gonna be trouble. Some of us won't survive. See, the boys and me mean business, busting out dead or alive. I can hear the hound dogs on my trail. All hell breaks loose. Alarm and sirens wail. Like the game, if you lose, go to jail. Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in the town. Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak, so don't you be around. Tonight there's gonna be trouble. I'm gonna find myself here. our system's fair. Hey, you, good-looking female, come here.
Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in the town. Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak, so don't you be around. Tonight there's gonna be trouble, I'm gonna find myself in. Tonight there's gonna be trouble, so don't you stay.
Hey, Ricky Warwick from Black Star Riders here, people, and you are listening to White Line Fever.
Okay, welcome back to White Line Fever, episode 72. Before I introduce our guest, a bit of housekeeping. We are on Twitter, WLF Podcast, and we are at whitelinefever.ning.com. And my guest, we're at Fox, and I've got fellow Wollongong exile, Matty Russell. How are you?
Are you in Wollongong ex-gone, Steve? Are you
really left? We're not there. If you had the choice, you would be there, wouldn't you? So we must be in exile.
I'm still there, and I'm hoping you come back soon.
Thanks, mate, thanks. So now, we're at Fox, and I've been here, did 360, but I want to talk to you about pronunciations of calling Warriors games, because you called a Warriors game at the weekend. We're used to having Andrew Voss, and Paul Kentstis give us the devil horns as he's left. I've never seen him do it before. So how did you go with the pronunciations calling the Warriors games, and why are you calling Warriors games?
Well, I'm lucky because I've done the under-20s for a long time, so I've been given the chance to practice my under-20s names, and I had a great coach in John Ackland who coached the under-20s to premierships, and he told me a few of the key sounds and how to approach them. So Tuimoolo Lolo here, Solomona Carter, Lissone and Vete off the bench. Once you say them a few times, they do tend to roll off the tongue. And I've always said, when it comes to pronunciations, I will do everything to get the sounds right and give the players the names they want. I can't put accents on, but I'll ask a player to his face. It's the golden rule. Unless a player tells me, I don't believe it until I've heard it from his mouth.
And in reverse, so you've got someone who is a son of a family that's migrated to Australia or to anywhere else, and they pronounce their name with an Australian accent, and you go back to New Zealand as you have, and then they tell you the correct ethnic pronunciation of that name. How do you make a decision on how to say it?
I simply say to the player, what do you call yourself? And they might say a bastardised version. I say, well, what do your mum and dad call themselves, and how are they going to react if I pronounce your name that way? If they still stick with it, then it's easy. The only times I get confused is when the player is confused. And I reckon I say to the players in these under-20 rookie camps, boys, you get a season or two to get your name right. After that, it will be Petro Sivanasiva forever and not Petro Thivanatheva. So you've got a couple of years. Like Matt Gillette or Matt Gillett was right on the cusp. I reckon if it had gone another year, he would have been Matt Gillette for the rest of his life. As it is, he wanted it Gillett, so it's Matt Gillett.
No one ever invites me to speak to rookies at rookie camp. Have a look at me. So, Matty, how did you end up here? I mean, I knew you calling under-20s. I mean, this must be sitting in here in this brand-new multi-million dollar building. You must pinch yourself.
I do pinch myself because I started in newspapers in Orange, went to Win TV in Orange, down to Win TV Wollongong, came to Fox Sports as a news reporter, presenter. That's my bread and butter. They needed someone to do the under-20s. I've always loved league. I've always covered league. I actually called a Group 10 grand final with the great Bert Gordon flashing down the sideline there in Cowra. So league had been in my blood. I was asked to commentate 20s. Did it. One thing went to another. And when I was tapped on the shoulder to call a bit of NRL, I felt blessed.
Yeah.
I felt lucky. I'm still wondering why. And to be here, well, it's the best job in the world, isn't it?
Everyone wonders about research and stuff. And I suppose everyone's got their own little habits and their own little curiosities when they're doing research and they're doing prep. What are yours? You got any prep underpants that you wear every week, or have you got any superstitions?
Two great pieces of prep that I do. I've got some playing cards numbered 1 to 17. It's an hour and 10 minutes on a good run from Wollongong to Sydney, right? So I, both hands on the wheel, shuffle the deck, 1 to 17, move the cards between my hand and get the numbers and names in my head, so when you're calling, you know who's in what number.
Both hands, how do you shuffle? You're driving. What do you do with this?
Don't tell the police. But the shuffling's done beforehand. You just simply move them around from one hand to the other. The other thing is I carry a manila folder, 1 to 17 down either side. Every bit of nugget of gold I get on a player I write for that week, like in terms of where they've come from, how many games they've played. So stuff you can weave in. It's all in front of you on one manila folder, except for those 150 stats and pages you get.
And so how do you decide between putting in some stats and something that's a bit dry and something that's a bit humorous, you know, like, I don't know, he went to a fancy dress ball dressed as Batman or something. Like, I mean, you know, like, what's the balance between that sort of stuff?
You just want a mixture. You want basically 4 points on each player and you want a mixture. You need to know what clubs they've played for, what milestones they're coming up, what they've achieved from a rugby league point of view, but a bit of gold that, you know, like he used to play sport X or sport Y or come back from this injury, et cetera, et cetera. That goes in there. You just want a mix of information so it's not all numbers, because let's face it, after you've had three or four cans on a Saturday afternoon, you're sitting on the lounge arguing with the kids, trying to keep the missus happy.
You don't want tackle busts.
The last thing you want is a wave of numbers, but you need to give the people who are rugby league nerds enough numbers.
So I want to ask you about, and this is the thing I suppose people who don't work in the media, especially electronic media, always wonder, and they never hear anyone talk about, is nerves and how you rationalise what you're doing and how you think, how you go from, you don't want to think that it's trivial and not important, but you don't want to think it's so important that if you stuff up, your world ends. So have you rationalised it in your head? Like, before you go on air, do you go, okay, I'm just going to be myself. I wouldn't stuff up if I was talking to someone in the pub, so why should I stuff up on camera? Or do you think, if I stuff up, it's the end of the world? Have you rationalised in your own head how it all works?
When I first started calling NRL, I was dreadfully nervous. I believed, what on earth am I doing here? I don't know whether I deserve this. And I quickly learned that I thought, well, even if that's the case, unless you get over that, you're going to suck. You're never going to have a future in this career. Yeah. I still get nervous. The butterflies and the countdown from 10 to on air are the worst of the game. As soon as you take that first hit up or say that first word, you're right. But
that's what I hate about around the grounds, because when you're around the grounds, you're only on for a few seconds. So you've... if you stuff up, the stuff up hangs there for, you know, the next 15 minutes till they come to you again. You know?
It is very, very hard, but it is an actual effort to say to myself, hang on, this is fun. We watch sport for fun. It's not the end of the world. You have to make yourself be confident, be happy, be relaxed, because if you don't, it's going to come over. And I'd be lying if I said that came naturally. It doesn't. You have to actually, in that 10 to 1 count, I say to myself, feel happy, be cool. You know, just, it's going to be all right.
But see, we're sitting here talking now. There's no actual reason why we should be more stressed talking on television than we are now with 100 listeners. That's what I go, there's no reason. Like if I was talking to my mate, I wouldn't stumble over my words. I wouldn't forget, you know what I mean? I wouldn't forget someone's name. I wouldn't accidentally swear if I didn't want to. So why would that happen to me on the radio or the TV? It shouldn't, but that's where you get yourself tied up. You think too much. You know?
You're spot on. And I suppose you do realise that in this world, there is a world of social media waiting for every stumble, slip up, every factual error. You just, and you know you are going to know about it because they have access to you now, which is good. Because it means that your performances are honestly and genuinely appraised by a much bigger audience than you would normally have. And as I say to people, to be better, it's no use being slapped on the shoulder being told everything you're doing right. You need to be being told by people what you're doing wrong. Like, I remember a couple of years ago, you know, there's an expression in racing, has a full book of rides. I think I said they've got a full book of tackles. And I got a couple of tweets straight away from people saying, full book of tackle at Matt Russell Fox, what on earth? And I thought, well, that's right. That's probably an expression from a different
sport. But how do
you
deal with the abusive ones? Like some people just like to poke and get a reaction. 100%. So how do you deal with that?
You realise that probably their life is more miserable than yours. But sometimes, you know, you think, well, okay, I look for a point in it. Because I think you can, even get from the most cynical, vindictive person, there can be a positive come out of it. And you think, if I get something positive out of that bit of statement, then I'm actually winning. They're not. So, mind battle, mate.
Okay, Matty, let's talk about one rugby league issue. Everyone's talking about they're bringing down the interchange. Good or bad?
Great. Not good, great. Because I think that we need a game that caters for all body shapes. I think it does at the moment, but I think we are seeing more and more muscle-bound hulks, less and less skillful, nimble, slim, agile people. I'm sure that a lot of good rugby league players are just discarded by clubs because they're beanpoles. You look at a Matt Moylan, he's maybe an exception. You look at a few others along those lines. I'd like to see a more accurate depiction of a cross-section of society. Yeah, and at the moment, I don't think we're getting that.
Yeah, okay, that's great. We need fewer muscle-bound hulks like you and I in rugby league. Thanks for joining us, Matt. I just want to say that we're on Stitcher. I also want to say that if you go to whitelinefever.ning.com and click on Amazon, then it doesn't cost you any more to shop on Amazon, but I get a little bit of a cut. And you can also hit donate. And I'm sorry I don't have the list of donors in front of me, it's even though it's very short. So I'll mention it next time. Thanks for joining us, Matt. Here's some new music from UFO.
Beautiful. Pleasure to be here. Anytime, mate.
A story of possession, oh, the kingdom kind. He went out guns a-blazing, his shirt ragged in the wind. I watched him delicately frazzled, his lights they slowly dimmed. Not cold at all, it's my demon talking. Feeling so bold, it's my sugar talking. Whoa, whoa. This love is fatal, but oh so sublime. Love that's killing, this love is the killing kind. I have been taken, I have been blind. This love is the killing kind. Stick a situation, I've been here before. Burr up that greasy wheel and go singing like a whore. You wanna hear about the honey, you wanna hear about the game. When you look into her darkness, baby's got a sense of pain. Cold at all, it's my demon talking. Feeling so good, it's my sugar talking. Whoa, whoa. This love is fatal, but oh so sublime. The love that's killing, this love is the killing kind. I have been taken, I have been blind. This love is killing, this love is the killing kind.
Fred Corey from Cinderella, and you are listening to White Line Fever. White Line Fever.
Okay, welcome back. Final part of our interview with Craig Songrady from BB Steel, and we've talked about the past. We've talked about their video being put on a porn site. So let's talk about Resurrection and sort of the songwriting. Was it when you were writing this? Is this from a songwriting point of view, Craig? Is this your work, or is it members of your current lineup contributed to the songwriting, or what, how did it come together?
Oh, it's various. A few of the songs there wrote. No, actually, one I really wrote on completely on my own. But I wrote most of them with a guy called Tony McDowell, who he actually plays in Swanee now. Tony's a great, amazing guitar player. He's just had so many commitments. He works with a music distribution company. He's always floating around and could have never nailed him down for a gig because we had quite a few gigs come up. And we sat down and wrote some songs and put some ideas together and went to a little shack on the River Murray with the ideas we had and took a small, like a digital Porter studio and a bunch of amps and effects, and set up there for about a week and a half with, you know, 2 tons of alcohol, not that I don't drink much, but and just tons of food, and there was no one around, so we just concentrated on nutting this out. So we did the basic pre-production over a two-week period, and then the rest of it we went in to start at Mixmaster Studios in Adelaide, which is an old SSL console, which, ironically, it was the one out of the old Rhino Studios, which we did the first Boss album on.
Right.
And it was the same console. It blew us out. But, so originally owned by the guys from NXS, way back. Mm. But, yeah, we recorded that. We went through a bit of a journey with it. Some people wanted keyboards on it. There was a bone of contention with drum sounds. I wanted it heavier. And other people, Pete at the time, as much as a genius, he said that you won't get played on radio. I said, mate, I don't want to get played on radio because they won't play us anyway. Look, if we keep, and it's something the guys out of, Cornell said, if we wrote songs to be played on radio, we wouldn't be where we are now. And I think that was with Soundgarden.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, like, because we, these songs have got some great dark chords in them, but you just don't, they don't, you don't hear them as much as I wanted to hear them. I wanted to be a bit more guitar heavy and a bit more drum heavy. And it was pulled back a bit. This, look, it rocks. You turn it up loud, it rocks. But live, the band, you'd use about 5 of those songs, 6 live. And then we use about 5 or 6 of the On the Edge album. And we're going to incorporate a couple of the Boss album songs when we actually get out and get back to Sydney. But when we play them live, it's like another world. People, you know, we did some Angels gigs, did some gigs with various bands that have come out, and they've just gone, holy hell, you just sound like, you know, it just sounds like a jet engine, you know, it's just rocks. They say it's cross between AC/DC and Zeppelin.
Yeah, yeah.
And Soundgarden, you know, live, you know, they say my vocals when I'm singing live sounds a bit like, you know, Cornell.
Yeah.
And Gillan, they say.
What have you made over the years of all the Def Leppard comparisons? Have you always thought that was a compliment, or did it get annoying after a while?
Look, you know, it's a real hard one, that one. You know, I've talked to Phil because I was living with Phil Collin, had a Def Leppard in while we were doing production on that, and talked to him about it in depth. And when we were in the studio in Canada, we were talking about a song that's on that album, On the Edge, and it's a song called Ride On, and which sounds so much like the song Hysteria. And we were looking at that, and I said, you know, they sound similar, and it was actually going to sound even more similar because he put this guitar line in, because he was playing guitar on a few bits. We're in a Canadian studio, and I said, let's do a favour. Let's both write on a piece of paper what song we were influenced or ripped off truly to get that vibe of that song. And he went, okay. So he wrote on a piece of paper, and I wrote on a piece of paper, and then we swapped them. He looked at mine, and he went, oh, my God, we had the same. It was We Can Be Heroes, David Bowie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he said, that's how I got that riff. And I said, that's how I got that riff. But we didn't, you know, we're on opposite sides of the world. We, you know, really, we knew each other from the High and Dry gigs, you know, we did with them. Way back at Selena's, and we clicked then, and their management actually saw us live and wanted to manage us. It was just before the drummer lost his arm, and I rang and talked to Peter Mensch, his name was, and he said, look, we don't even know if we're going to band because our drummer has just lost his arm. And so that never happened. It would have been fantastic if it did, but Phil and I, you know, we keep in touch. I was talking to him in LA when I was over there about a year ago, and he's pumped. He's like, if you see him, he looks like he's got a body of the Adonis, you know. Totally.
Yeah, he's like a vegan, isn't he? He doesn't.
total vegan. He was a vegan way back then, you know, like way back. He hasn't touched alcohol, hasn't touched anything, but he's a fitness guy, and they tour so much, like they have not stopped. I reckon they're one of the hardest working bands on the planet.
Yeah.
And they're filling out arenas. They're doing amazing stuff, you know.
So, are you still in touch with Phil Collins? Is there any sort of prospect of working with them or working with him again?
I don't know. I spoke to him, like I said, about a year ago when I was in Los Angeles. We were going to catch up, but he was about to go on tour, I think, with Kiss. And he was, you know, he's a busy man, and he was visiting his guitar tech, and I couldn't make it because I was actually with the voice at Countdown. It's funny, driving around. And
Wood.
Went to, what's his name? What's the Countdown? God, Gavin, of course, Gavin Wood. We're driving in LA in his Toyota, and we were going to Max Merritt's, because there's a bunch of Aussies that all live there, and we're going to Max Merritt's 70th birthday, and that's when Phil rang, so I couldn't pull myself away from that. It was a fantastic event. I remember grabbing Max and went out to Max's V-Dub Beetle and put the CD in and listened to my couple of songs, and he put in his stuff and listened to some of his new songs, and yeah, it was great. And I thought, what a great vibe. Here I am sitting next to a legend, you know. Max Merritt, God, what a legend he is. But yeah, they call them the Debonairs over there. They got a Debonairs club there and a Debonairs one in Sydney and Melbourne. Bunch of people have been in the industry forever, you know. As far as going with doing any gigs with Leps, well, I would always love to. I spoke to Phil about it. What they're doing to keep the heads at gigs, usually the bands, you know, they're paying to get on these, a lot of the gigs, and they're touring with big acts like Kiss, Cheap Trick, bands that have had massive hits. So it's kind of a bit harder now to get on them. The only hope we have really of doing stuff is getting on those, some of those European, you know, rock concerts that through, you know, Germany and Sweden. It's just what we're trying to do is we really need representation, someone that really knows the territory. And it's actually over there and can travel and been there and actually, you know, punt it to them, you know.
And
Clark, anyway, doing it.
Before you go, you said that you've already pretty much got another record written. Is that right?
Yeah, just doing the lyrics, but the music side of it, yeah, it's actually really, really, really good. I played it to a mate of mine the other day and he just smiled and he went, holy shit, you're back. You know, it's like, it's rocking. I mean, don't get me wrong, the Resurrection Hour's got some magic and it's got some bits there that, are, you know, I went, no, yeah, well, I'd love to fix that, but the budget doesn't allow it, you know, but it is a really good song. I mean, it all depends on the demographic. So many people love listening to it, but they're, you know, the purest hard rock heads, it's not. There are some songs that are rock and there's some songs that almost got a Hendrix funky vibe, and then there's, I think it rocks live. I know it's how it sounds and it's the way it should sound.
Mate, can we have one more song from you?
Yeah, what, off an old album or...
Your choice.
Okay. Well, I tell you what I really love is Lizzie Town, which is On the Edge, the opening track of the On the Edge album.
A lot of great Australian musicians come out of Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Just about all of them, actually.
yeah, tons of them did. I don't know. I think it's because what the influence was back then is Bad Company and Free, all the British, all the guys came over from England and Scotland, like Barnsley, Swanee, even Bon Scott was in. Yeah, he lived down the road from where I am now. Mm. He lived in Aldgate for a while, and he had a song he wrote, which is about his woman he was living with back then. And it's a guy in Sydney, he's got the song, and it was never recorded, but Bon wrote it. And he asked me, actually, would you like to try and record this? And
oh, wow.
I said, gee, it'd be a bloody honour, you know, to do that.
What's it called?
But, he used to play with, pardon?
What's the song called?
I don't know the name of it. It's about, it's named after his girlfriend.
All right.
Yeah, it was because Bon lived in Adelaide, and I think he was with Fraternity and a few different bands around that era. But yeah, there's been a few dudes, but they've come over and brought the British influence with them.
Mm.
You know, T-Rex and Gary Glitter, the whole thing, and it really, really stuck, and it influenced me a hell of a lot. You know.
Mm. And is this song something that you might put on the new record, or you know the song yet, or he's got to play it?
No, I've heard him. I was playing. It was at the Beach Hotel in Sydney,
yep.
And he played it on piano to me and sang it rough and showed me the lyrics, and it's got Bon Scott and the signature on it. It's a really old piece of paper.
Mm.
I said, mate, that'd be awesome. It's something I'll really have a close look at, you know, but not sure about this album. This album, you never know. You never know. Once I start recording this one, I'm going to do them in blocks of four, and because I don't care if it takes another year, 2 years to finish it, but it's going to sound right again, and I've got the best console that was invented, and I'm going to do it on a 24-track Studer A820, which is going to go on tape, so you've got that old fat sound. I'm going to run that into MIDI converters, into the old Neve console and out, and into Cubase. So it's going to have a really analog-y fat sound.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us, Craig.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Keep them prisoner. Hi, it's Craig from BB Steel. Great to be on White Lion Fever with Steve Mascord. Hope to see you out in the gig soon.
Okay, it's the third part of our interview with Cormac Neeson from The Answer, and we are in danger, badly in danger, running overtime, so I'll have to be quick. But I read in probably the most recent article that appears anywhere on the internet about you was in a local newspaper and talked about you had a three-month-old son. Now, that must be a really kind of a problematic thing when you're about to go back on the road, you're about to promote a new record, a new experience, a new thing to grapple with, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it's been a pretty crazy few months for myself and for my wife and for my baby boy. He arrived 3 months before he should have.
All right.
I was born at a whopping 1 pound 12 ounces.
Oh, wow.
So it's been a long, old process kind of building him up and getting him well. He's still in hospital. He should be getting out any day now, we're hoping. And of course, back before Christmas, I was thinking, oh, you know, I'll get him home and get him settled way before we have to think about going out on the road and promoting this record. But every day he's in hospital now, I'm thinking that's another day closer to having to leave him for, I mean, the touring. Obviously, I knew I was having a kid, so the tour, we've got kind of penciled in that I'm never away from home for too long. You know, I'll be back regularly, but at the same time, you know, the wee fella's been so poorly over the last while, and he's just starting to really kind of come into his own.
Mm.
You don't want to ever leave him, you know, but that's life. It's kind of the role we chose whenever we decided to become full-time musicians, and you just have to balance things as well as you possibly can.
Yeah. I read that you got on quite well with AC/DC when you were touring with them and played Madison Square Garden with them and stuff. Is that an ongoing relationship? I mean, do you have contact with them, and how have you viewed their return? They were pretty spectacular on the at the Grammys, weren't they?
Yeah, I know. Fantastic. Yeah, you know, we'd still be in touch with the guys, still be in touch with the kids as well. You know, we kind of got close to the whole extended AC/DC family on that tour. I mean, the new record, it's going to be great. You know, the touring is to get those guys back on the road again is a real treat.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll hopefully catch a few shows. Hopefully our paths will cross over the next year or so, and I'm sure it will. But yeah, I wish them all the best. They're still right up there.
Yeah, we're almost out of time. One parochial Australian question before I go, Cormac. Your surname, you'd be aware who Doc Neeson is, wouldn't you? From the Angels, from Angel City.
yeah, it's crazy that, isn't it? They were on the same label as us as well. It's funny how our paths cross.
No relation.
Relation, unfortunately, no.
Okay, are we going to see you here on this trip?
Yeah, we're hoping to get down to Australia. I'm constantly in our booking agency here, just hassling them, trying to get them to book us a tour of Australia, because it's been a few years now since we've been down, and we don't want you folks forgetting who we are.
Okay, well, it's time for you to go on to your next interview. I appreciate your time, and we'll get one more song off you.
All right, why don't you give the title track a spin, Raise a Little Hell.
For the ride, I caught it just to get away. Something. Zappa.
I got a white line fever. Going down, land down under. Going to turn around the corner, way down yonder. And I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. And you get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever. Rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.